strangers. She had never met the expedition's leader, Canon Douglas, although she had heard all about the good and able musician-priest from Natalie and George. Alice had also heard about New York conductor sensation Kurt Schindler from Natalie, and read about him too, as Schindler's chorus was receiving rave reviews and national attention. Even so, except for Natalie, Alice was about to depart civilization with complete strangers. Alice loved to be alone in nature and sought solitude on La Jolla's rocky shoreline and in the hills and scrub desert outside of San Diego. She had thrice sailed across the Atlantic for extended, even rigorous travels through Europe and the Mediterranean. But the physically demanding journey by horseback she was about to undertake with Natalie into the remote, uninhabited, dangerous, and still very much uncivilized Southwest wilderness was an extreme adventure the likes of which the 42-year-old Alice had never attempted. That first night, Natalie and Alice left California and rode the Santa Fe train across a bright, moon-infused desert to Arizona. Alice was unable to sleep in their shared Pullman car, her discomfort as much psychological as material. "I felt sick enough to ponder the imbecility of undertaking the trip with strangers," she scribbled in her small journal. The next afternoon, Alice's spirits were lifted by thundershowers that cooled the smoldering desert, and her well-being and optimism returned when the train stopped for supper at the comfortable, immaculate, and professionally staffed Harvey House in the tiny outpost of Ash Fork, Arizona. After dinner and a tour of the Harvey House Indian Curios room, Natalie and Alice reboarded the train at dusk and continued east to their rendezvous in Holbrook with Douglas. As their train came into Holbrook, the moonlight on the desert and the absolute stillness of the night cast a surreal quality onto their arrival. Alice and Natalie's midnight train was met by the good Canon Douglas, who alone, Eric was asleep, carried their bags to their room in a hotel. The hotel was not on a par with a Harvey House, and Holbrook was nothing more than the Santa Fe Depot by the single track and a dirt street with a few stores, a bank, and a post office. If Alice had concerns about the quality of their lodgings and was still harboring doubts about the wisdom of following the priest into the outback, Douglas assuaged her unease and discomfort when he brought the women a late supper in their room. A night of sleep in a lumpy bed in a third-rate hotel completely refreshed Alice. With Natalie, she breakfasted with Douglas and Eric. After a day of errands and preparations that included a visit to the bank and a last laundry and bath, Natalie and Alice went with the Douglas men to meet Schindler's train. It was a happy and much-anticipated reunion for Natalie and Schindler, who had not seen one another since Natalie left New York with Mimsy last winter. Alice had heard all about the brilliant and eccentric musician Kurt Schindler. Even so, his appearance and demeanor astonished her. After meeting him at the Holbrook Depot that evening, Alice wrote, "With all N.C.'s hints and suggestions, I was not prepared in fullness. Curious, sensitive, attenuated being. Looks like a Navajo Zuni Indian who had just crawled out of a sunless cavern, completely bleached out, and with a much quickened interest in his fellow man, which a Navajo would succeed much better in hiding." The Curtis Douglas entourage enjoyed one last supper in civilization at a small Holbrook diner called The Cottage, and then, with two teams and a wagon carrying their camping gear, a Wrangler friend of Douglas's named Ted Whitaker, and several more saddle horses and pack animals, the two women and four men left Holbrook for the open desert. At 8 in the evening, Saturday, August 9th, their journey began much like Roosevelt's 3 weeks before, under the surreal light of the quarter moon, with Mercury, the evening star, sparking in the west for an hour after sundown. They struck north for Ganado and the settlement at Hubble's trading post, where they would camp a few nights among the folks who attended the annual late-summer Navajo fair. It was a track that would take the horses and wagons 4 days, following the tracks of previous teams that had made this journey before them. Even with the fine quarter moon lighting their way, Douglas and Whitaker lost the trail several hours out, and they had to retrace their tracks for several miles. They made camp where they found the trail again, and even though it was impromptu, and they'd lost several hours looking for the route north, everyone slept well. The dawn was a fine one, and before breakfast, Alice slipped away with her sketchbook to make a drawing of the sun lighting the sky over the empty, silent Arizona sandland. Douglas, Natalie, and Whitaker had traveled between Holbrook and Ganado and were familiar with the route to Cottonwood Wash and a campsite Douglas had used 2 years before. To Alice's eyes, though, the landmarks that marked the trail across the desert were often imperceptible, and she, like Schindler, had to abandon all notions of self-reliance and place her fate in the hands of the expedition leader. Early in the afternoon, on their first day out, Alice and Natalie shed their travel skirts for more appropriate desert riding apparel, split skirts of heavy cotton, and left the wagon and rode horseback alongside Douglas, Eric, and Schindler. Schindler was stoically managing blisters, sore muscles, sunburn, and chafed surfaces after a long hot day in the unfamiliar embrace of a western saddle. On previous trail rides, Natalie had come to terms with the non-genteel aspects of riding astride a horse. But Alice had never ridden a western saddle, and had to quickly adjust her sense of propriety. "Don't like it astride a bit," she wrote in her journal, "and couldn't ride side saddle in my skirt if I could get a side saddle." The horses and wagon followed a route that was never more than tracks in sand or ruts through arroyos, and that took the riders up steep mesas, across slick rock, and around jagged stone outcroppings to Twin Buttes. They were in the fantastic country of the Desierto Pintado, the Painted Desert, the region the Navajo called Halchita, among the red areas. At 6,000 feet above sea level, the huge swath of eccentrically eroded and multicolored sandstone, clay, and volcanic rock was brilliantly striated. The hues and forms of the desert changed hourly with the movement of the sun and the shadows of the clouds. It was fine country to be swallowed up in, and a visual feast for a painter. Alice likened the landscape to the Holy Land, and remarked how the colors of the desert belonged in a Jules Guérin painting. Each day they moved farther into the wild. Natalie welcomed the transformation wrought by desert life. She, like Douglas, knew the Colorado Plateau outback would work its magic on Alice, Schindler, and young Eric, even as it had on her and George a decade ago. The physical and emotional challenges endemic to wilderness travel on horseback, and the confidence and resiliency earned as those challenges were successfully met and overcome, were life-altering. Natalie wrote, "For us, the sordid bargaining of our narrowed city lives, the fret and whirl of petty currents that bear us so far from our inner goal, all were forgotten in that enchanted land." Dawn on August 12th came with a soft pastel-colored sky and a herd of Navajo goats wandering into their camp near Indian Wells. Alice was the first to dress and leave the tent she shared with Natalie, and she hiked a sandhill and completed a sketch before Douglas even made the breakfast fire. Desert life settled into a comfortable routine. Expedition members became accustomed to their assigned tasks and chores, and confident in their riding and camping abilities. Douglas and Whitaker pushed the horses and riders north, their destination Hubble's Trading Post, a 2 days' ride in the wide riverbed of the Pueblo Colorado Wash that cut through the hard desert of the Diné to Ganado. Schindler took to wearing a bandana tied about his head, Navajo style. Douglas rode with his shirt sleeves rolled to his elbows, but Natalie and Alice kept their sleeves buttoned down around their wrists, their shirt collars up, and their necks wrapped with bandanas. Sun up till sun down, everyone lived beneath a broad-brimmed hat. Even with so much precaution, the sun exposure at this altitude was extreme and even dangerous, and 3 days into the desert, everyone was sunburned somewhere on their body. A drenching thunderstorm late on the afternoon of August 12th sent the expedition up and away from the Pueblo Colorado Wash, which became a raging river with flash floodwaters. They found shelter in the cedar trees on the side of a mesa, and after several hours the storm cleared and left the red desert fragrant beneath a perfectly formed double rainbow. Douglas and Whitaker led them in the approaching dusk to a camp on a hill near a dramatic volcanic mountain that the men climbed at sundown. Alice and Natalie remained by the campfire, listening to the haunting songs of Navajo shepherds camped nearby. After dark, when Douglas and the men had returned from their hike up the volcanic cone, one of the Navajo singers came to their camp and exchanged songs with Natalie. Traders and ranchers, anthropologists, adventurers, and adventurous tourists frequented the route Douglas and company were following between Holbrook and Ganado. The Diné, the Navajos who lived in family groups scattered across their 25,000-square-mile reservation, were becoming accustomed to Biligana, non-Navajo horse and wagon expeditions crossing Navajo land. Even so, encounters on such an enormous frontier were infrequent and remarkable. The usually reserved Diné often approached Natalie and Douglas's entourage. White women were rare in this remote country, and Natalie and Alice were a curiosity to the natives they encountered on the trail. On August 13th, they rode into Lacanitiel, Wide Reeds, and Hubble's trading post at Ganado. After 4 days on horseback in the glittering monotony of sun, rock, sky, and horizon, in a land where mesas floated like islands in a sand sea, coming into the Ganado Valley was like riding into modern civilization. Of course, Ganado was not modern. The homestead of John Lorenzo Hubble, known by everyone as Don Lorenzo, was one of very few parcels privately owned within the boundaries of the gigantic Navajo reservation. It had amenities like water, fresh food, and buildings that boasted wood floors and glass windows, but the post was extremely isolated, 50 miles west of Gallup and 65 miles northeast of Holbrook. The redstone and log trading post served as the stage stop, post office, supply store, farm and ranch outfitter, wool warehouse, stable and blacksmith, and trader of wool, goat, and sheepskins, and the finest Navajo blankets, rugs, and silver. Ganado also provided modern medical services at the first and soon largest Indian mission and hospital, which had been built by the Presbyterians in 1901. The waters of the Pueblo Colorado River filled a reservoir that irrigated fields of alfalfa, wheat, oats, and barley, a vineyard and an orchard of fruit trees, and the Hubble family's kitchen garden. The trading post also kept chickens and hogs, sheep, goats, cattle, saddle horses, and a small flock of peafowl to keep the rattlesnakes away. For horse and wagon travelers in 1913, riding in off the desert to Hubble's in mid-August was akin to finding an oasis in the Sahara. Don Lorenzo was a friend of both Douglas's and Natalie's. Natalie and George had stayed with the Hubbles on previous trips, and he arranged for their group to camp in a prime location in the trees near the trading post, and to take several meals a day in his family's house. This gave Natalie and company the best of both worlds, the privacy and space of their own tents at a distance from the busy trading post, and the cool and comfortable porches, dining, and sitting rooms of the Hubble family home. The thick-walled stone and mud dwelling housed a private museum of native crafts and was decorated floor to ceiling and across the vigas of the ceiling itself with Indian baskets, carvings, ceramics, and textiles. The paintings of contemporary artists who had stayed with the Hubbles were displayed throughout the home, and the shelves of the library in the Grand Salon held signed editions of America's best authors, including Mark Twain and Zane Grey. And every floor in the house boasted the finest examples of Navajo rugs found anywhere in the world. Like Louisa and John Wetherill's trading post and home, more than 100 miles to the northwest in Kayenta, Hubble's was a destination that outback travelers planned their itineraries around. Don Lorenzo had lived nearly all his life among the Navajos and spoke their language and understood the subtleties and complexities of their culture. Like the Wetherills, near Monument Valley, the Hubble home was a gathering place for archaeologists and anthropologists, writers and artists exploring the country of the mysterious Diné. The Hubble dinner table was usually a hub of energetic conversation, and Natalie and Douglas looked forward to evenings with Don Lorenzo. However, in 1913, following the death of Don Lorenzo's wife, Lena Ruby, the atmosphere around the trading post was somber, and Natalie's group hardly socialized with Hubble. They camped in the cedar trees of Ganado for 3 nights. The ground was flat and hard, and pockmarked by petrified wood and cactus, but there were the luxuries of ample shade and plenty of water for washing and bathing. Although Natalie, Alice, Douglas, and Eric enjoyed a daily dip in the Pueblo Colorado River, Schindler had become a devotee of the cowboy way and continued to take his daily bath in the camp's Dutch oven. 600 Navajos and Hopis came to Ganado on August 13th and 14th for the annual Indian Fair. There were 2 days of races and contests on horseback, and in the evenings there was storytelling around campfires. When word got out around the trading post and camp that Natalie was the woman who collected Indian songs, more than 20 Diné, came to her and Alice's tent, wanting to share chats and stories. On Monday, August 15th, Natalie, Douglas, and friends struck their comfortable camp in the cedar trees and said goodbye to their horses, which were left in Don Lorenzo's barn. They were to continue north to Chinle in Don Lorenzo's Ford machines. It was 35 miles of very slow going on a primitive road north through the wild and lovely Naslini Canyon, home to a community of small black bears sacred to the Navajos. To their west, across a wide ocean of buff-colored sand and low featureless plateaus, was Hopi Land. Below the horizon to their east were the cool, pine-covered slopes of the Chaska Mountains that marked the Arizona-New Mexico border. Recent rains had packed down the sand, but the wheels of the two Model Ts, considered good desert vehicles because of their four-cylindered, 20-horse-powered engines, were no match for the thick clay and mud. The drivers had to navigate the road's high centers, deep arroyos, and scrabbled inclines, and Alice and Natalie commented that horses and wagons were a better choice than the lurching, swerving Ford machines. Navajos came and went on horseback, and travelers in wagons passed by the noisy automobiles, both groups destined to arrive hours ahead of Natalie and Alice's company. They were driving due north to the great Canyon de Chelly, the labyrinthine canyon where 60 years before the Navajos hid from Kit Carson and the U.S. military in the ancient, inaccessible cliff villages abandoned long ago by the Anasazi, the ancestors of the Hopis. Douglas had explored Canyon de Chelly before, but it would be an inaugural visit for Natalie. The two Fords and their 8 passengers arrived at John Kirk's trading post near Canyon de Chelly in the late afternoon. Kirk's log and stone store was tucked into cottonwood trees against a small bluff a half mile from the entrance to the Great Canyon. Even so close to the massive stone labyrinth, the pastoral landscape surrounding the trading post gave travelers no clue about their proximity to the legendary canyon. Douglas had arranged for new drivers and guides, Ken Shelley, a Navajo from Fort Defiance, and a second guide named Brady, to accompany their group into the canyon. After an hour in the trading post, where Natalie, Schindler, and Alice talked with the locals who came in to trade and to have a cup of Arbuckle's coffee, Douglas shepherded everyone into the automobiles, and with new supplies of food and a load of dry firewood, they drove into the canyon. There would have been nothing that Douglas or Kirk or their guides could have told Alice, Natalie, and Schindler that would have prepared them for the hauntingly exquisite beauty that was Canyon de Chelly. It was dusk when they passed through the stone-walled gateway into the heart of the canyon. Sheer, smooth, red and gold stone rose hundreds of feet into the air on either side of the cottonwood-lined river. Until they departed the canyon 2 days later, all Natalie and Alice would see of the Arizona sky was the slice of blue held between the stone rims of Canyon de Chelly's vertical walls. Darkness fell, and a million stars crowded the sky above the canyon. The automobiles drove through a tunnel of darkness that followed the river. The skilled Navajo drivers, careful to keep the automobile's tires from the canyon's famous yellow quicksand that was known to suck vehicles into muck so deep they vanished completely. The full moon finally reached the sky beyond the stone rim and flooded the canyon with a luminous, otherworldly light. They set up camp on a high ledge of fine dry sand alongside a great bluff that gleamed in the moonlight. On the flat surface of smooth stone, Natalie, Alice, Douglas, and the men ate a late supper of bread and mackerel, olives and grape juice, with a nightcap of hot chocolate. The night was too beautiful and clear for tents, and no one bothered to even unpack the tarps, but slept in bedrolls on the open ground in the shade made by an enormous stone monolith. Alice lay awake and stared into the radiant nightscape that surrounded her, listening to the sound of horses hobbled somewhere in the canyon. Dawn came in a soft blush of color to the canyon rims. An hour later, the hot rays of the sun reached down the southwestern walls. The floor of the canyon was smooth white sand, and the river, lined by lush groves of cottonwood and fruit trees, wound through a chasm edged by sheer stone walls, rock towers, and polished buttes that stood more than 800 feet above the canyon floor. They saddled up the horses, brought in by the guides, and rode deeper into the canyon, past summer hogans, cornfields, orchards of peach trees, and small corrals of horses and goats that belonged to the Navajos who lived in the canyon. The destination was the White House ruin, tucked on a ledge under an immense stone overhang. After scrambling about the old pueblo, they rode up the tributary of Cañon de los Muertos, and from a stone ledge in the shade pondered the gruesome fate of Navajos who were slaughtered by the Spanish in Mummy Cave, several hundred feet above them. 2 days later, Natalie, Alice, Schindler, Douglas, Eric, and Whitaker re-emerged from Canyon de Chelly. At Kirk's trading post, they purchased supplies, repacked, and organized their gear into the Model Ts, and headed west for Keams Canyon, Hopi Land. It was Sunday, August 18th, but after 10 days in the outback, the calendar of the civilized world ceased to have meaning. Alice's journal entries, like her sense of time, had become untethered from dates and days of the week. Alice and Schindler now understood what Natalie and Douglas knew. When you traveled into the deep outback of Indian country, conventional time became irrelevant. Hours and days were measured by the movements of the sun and the moon, and time was of significance only in relation to the distance one needed to cross between sunup and sundown. Natalie flourished in the primordial landscape and delighted in the days and weeks spent wandering, roofless and free, over the sun-scorched deserts. For in them we quite lost the trail of the 20th century and of our materialistic and commercial civilization. Even the wrinkles and crow's feet that lined our white faces were burned away. In the silence of the desert and the sweep of pure winds, our souls were washed clean, till we, too, seemed true children of the Earth Mother and the Sky Father. 9. Wolpe Rendezvous. The spell of the desert comes back to me, as it always will come. I see the veils like purple smoke in the canyons, and I feel the silence. And it seems that again I must try to pierce both and to get at the strange wild life of the last American wilderness, wild still, almost as it ever was. Zane Grey. The road to Keams Canyon angled across the high desert to the south and west from Chinle, directly into the ocean of buff-colored sand plateaus. The same day they left Kirk's, at Canyon de Chelly, Natalie and Douglas's expedition left the mixed blessings of the Ford machines and transferred onto horses, with a team and wagon once again carrying their camping gear. The weather was cooler, and they were able to ride 15 miles to Salina Springs, where they set up camp in a thicket of cedar trees above the spring. The next morning, August 18th, they rode off the high plateau east of Low Mountain and followed Hadito Wash toward Peach Orchard Springs, Keams Canyon. By noon they rode down rock and sand bluffs into a herd of goats grazing in the peach trees, and stopped before the trading post owned by Don Lorenzo and run by his son, Lorenzo Hubble, Jr. An ancient village site of the Hopis, by 1913, Keams Canyon was as anglicized as any community found in Indian country. The BIA offices were within sight of the notorious Keams Canyon boarding school that Natalie, Lummis, and scores of other Indian rights activists had condemned for years. Superintendent Leo Crane was not a fan of Natalie Curtis's work among the Indians and would not have welcomed her arrival to Keams Canyon. However, in August 1913, Crane had been briefed by Washington officials that Natalie and her friends were slated to rendezvous with Theodore Roosevelt at the Snake Dance at Walpi. Crane and his agents were instructed to accommodate Roosevelt and Curtis and to provide an office at Third Mesa where the ex-president and the ethnomusicologist could meet. Agent Crane had served as superintendent of the Hopis for only 2 years, yet his tyrannical style of management, he continued to send Navajo policemen into the Hopi villages to round up schoolchildren, and his palpable animosity toward all Indians, who in his estimation lived on a moral plane little above their livestock, made him deeply disliked in Tusayan. Crane was suspicious of traders like Hubble and the open-mouthed tourists, curio hunters, actresses, authors, and moving picture fans who revered all things Indian. And Crane absolutely detested the annual heathen affair called the Snake Dance that brought hordes of Indian-loving outsiders into whatever Hopi village was sponsoring the ceremony. Crane wanted outsiders kept outside and the immoral Hopis kept under his firm, civilizing hand. A persistent and bothersome thorn in Agent Crane's side was Natalie's collaborator and friend, Tawa Kwaktiwa, now the Kik Mungwai of old Oribe. The Oribe split of 1906 had precipitated social and political realignments among the Hopis, and Chief Tawa Kwaktiwa was seen as both a hero and a scoundrel among his own people. Crane detested Tawa Kwaktiwa and was particularly perturbed by the adulation and recognition Miss Natalie Curtis had given Lalilamai's nephew in the Indian's book. Even if Crane had no patience for her work in preserving Indian music and culture, he understood the place of privilege Tawamana, songwoman Natalie Curtis, held in Hopi land. He would be outwardly courteous and helpful to Natalie and her traveling companions, but he would be relieved when the spectacle of the snake dance was over and all meddlesome outsiders, famous and not, departed Indian country. After Natalie's friends enjoyed a leisurely stopover at the Hubble Keynes Canyon store, they remounted and rode east 11 miles across a well-used but very rocky road to Polaca, the outpost below the imposing rock promontory of First Mesa. The sand drifted in deep dunes across the road that wound up and down treacherous ledges and bald rock outcroppings. It was obvious to Alice why the Ford machines were left at Canyon Dichet. A dozen autos a week were stranded on this road, defeated by the steep ascents or swallowed up by sand that reached to their hubcaps. Natalie, Alice, Douglas, and the others reached First Mesa in the afternoon. In the shade of a large peach orchard, they set up tents, tarps, and their outdoor kitchen within walking distance of the stone trading post, yet another establishment owned by Don Lorenzo Hubble. They would remain at this camp beneath First Mesa for at least the next week. It had been 8 years since Natalie had trod the trail up to the Hopi villages of Walpi and Sikamovi, and the Tewa Hopi village of Hano on the slender island of rock that was First Mesa. She was eager to see Nampeo, and before dusk led everyone but Alice, who confessed to her diary that she was cross, tired, and of no help anyway, up the narrow path to Hano, perched on the mesa 600 feet above the desert floor. The sinking sun cast purple and rose hues onto the desert below the trail, and the air was fragrant with the scent of cedar fires and burnt sage. As they ascended the mesa, the dusk silence was laced with the calls of ravens, the bells of goats, and the shouts of the village children. Natalie took Douglas, Schindler, Eric, and Whitaker directly to Nampeo's home, where they were warmly welcomed by Nampeo and her family. Nampeo was nearly blind now, but continued to make pottery with her daughter Nellie. Nampeo's pottery, like that of the Tewa artist Maria Martinez at San Ildefonso Pueblo in New Mexico, had become the gold standard by which Native American ceramics were evaluated. With the publicity boost brought to her pottery by the Indian Department of the Fred Harvey Company and the Santa Fe Railway, Nampeo's ceramics were collected by museums and by connoisseurs of fine Indian arts and crafts. After a quick tour of Hano in the soft light of the August dusk, Natalie and Douglas led Eric, Schindler, and Whitaker back down the mesa. Later that night, from the warmth of her bedroll on the open ground below First Mesa, Natalie pondered the fragility of the traditional life of her Hopi friends. Nampeo's pottery and the craftwork of other emerging Native artists were bringing collectors directly into the villages and communities of Native America. Staring up at the stars twinkling through the branches of the peach trees, Natalie wondered if it was possible to stop or even slow the tide of Anglo-Saxon iconoclasm that would sweep the Hopi Indian villages from their ancient sites. Natalie's desert idyll ended the next morning. Roosevelt and his expedition were coming in on horseback from the north, and the news of the former president's arrival moved through the native and non-native communities on and below First Mesa like an electric current. After weeks without even a passing thought about the condition of her appearance, Natalie was suddenly conscious of her disheveled clothes and tangled hair. Weeks in the Arizona desert do indeed restore one to an atavistic, primitive state in outward appearance, as in inner peace of mind, Natalie reflected. I was travel-stained from head to foot, and on the front of my khaki riding skirt, flared with placid disregard of all conventions, a large round circle of black axle grease, where the camp wagon had branded me for my affront of trying to climb in over the front wheel. Alice, Douglas, and Schindler understood how important Natalie's appointment with Roosevelt was to her, but with each of them looking equally rumpled and unkempt, skin sun-dried and burned, hair matted under hats, lips chapped, boots scuffed, shirts discolored by sweat and horsehair, Natalie's sudden need to be presentable, indeed professional, became the subject of much camp humor. Douglas and Schindler thought the grease stain decorating the front and center of Natalie's riding skirt made a fine Indian sun symbol and ought to be left alone. But if she insisted on removing the grease stain, the men told Natalie nothing short of a bath in gasoline would do the job. Burning the skirt seemed a more prudent solution. Natalie left her unsympathetic compadres beside the breakfast fire and marched off alone in search of gasoline. In the BIA buildings at Palaka, agency workers were mopping floors and scrubbing surfaces for Roosevelt. Next door at the schoolhouse, the teacher was cleaning up the students and the classroom for the president and had no time to help Natalie with her stain. She did, however, offer Natalie the use of any cup she could find. After locating a handleless vessel in the school's kitchen, Natalie went outside and found a man standing beside his parked automobile. "I need gasoline," Natalie told him, gesturing at her skirt. After telling Natalie she was welcome to as much gasoline as she could extract from his auto's tank, the man quickly left to join the crowd gathering on the far side of the mesa to greet Roosevelt's expedition as they rode in from the desert. Natalie had no idea where the vehicle's gas tank was located and was accepting defeat when a horse and rider appeared. Presently, a handsome and deep-tanned young cowboy in blue overalls passed me, leading some horses. Natalie later wrote of that August morning, "I wonder if you could get me some gasoline from this car. I am allowed to have it. You see, we are all trying to clean up in honor of Colonel Roosevelt. He is expected today sometime." The young man smiled, dismounted, and within moments lay in utter chivalry under the car, milking the gasoline into my cup. He soon slid out from under the auto, handed Natalie the handleless cup filled with gasoline, gathered up the horses he was leading, remounted his horse, and with a tip of his hat, trotted away. Carefully balancing the cup with the precious cleaning agent, Natalie walked back toward the camp in the orchard. As she crested a low rise, she stopped. A stalwart figure on a cow pony was riding up the hill, alone and unattended. Without any flourish of trumpets, Colonel Theodore Roosevelt had arrived. His sunburned face was partly shaded by a big Stetson hat. A red bandana fluttered at his throat, and he, too, looked as though gasoline might improve his khakis. I waved my sombrero and cried, "Hail to the chief!" Roosevelt had arrived at First Mesa. Undetected by his great herd of fans, only the tiny, tanned, smiling Natalie Curtis welcomed the president to Hopi Land. Theodore Roosevelt enjoyed a big entrance before a large, boisterous, adoring crowd. Henry James described him as the mere monstrous embodiment of unprecedented and resounding noise. But on this particular August morning, under the hot sun and brilliant cerulean sky of Indian country, Theodore Roosevelt rode into the outpost at Palaka, the iconic Western loner. Even his doting and protective sons were not with him. Roosevelt recognized his friend immediately and leaned down from his saddle to grasp Natalie's outstretched hand. It was so like Roosevelt, Natalie would later say, to appear where no one expected him, ahead of the rest of the world. The night before, while Natalie had contemplated the universe from her bedroll under the peach trees, Roosevelt had done much the same on the hard ground of a mud flat in the desert north of First Mesa. With his sons Archie and Quentin, and his 19-year-old cousin Nicholas, and with John Wetherill and two Navajo guides, Roosevelt had ridden 3 days through the mountains of Black Mesa and down across the roadless country of low cliffs and blood-red buttes between Kayenta and Walpi. After 6 weeks on horseback, camping on rims, in pine forests, and under the Great Rainbow Bridge in canyons so untouched by humans as to be unnamed and unmapped, Roosevelt had become immersed in what Natalie fondly called the desert dream. Only those who live and sleep in the open, Roosevelt wrote in his notebook, fully realize the beauty of dawn and moonlight and starlight. After several minutes of casual chat, Roosevelt told Natalie she needed to meet his son, and turned in his saddle and called out for Archie. A few moments later, the handsome cowboy knight in overalls, who had filled Natalie's cup with siphoned petrol, rode up alongside his father. "We have met today before," a smiling Archie said to his speechless Natalie. There was almost no gasoline in Natalie's cup, as it had quickly evaporated into the dry air, but Natalie didn't care any more about cleaning up her skirt. No explanations were necessary. She was among kindred spirits. Winfred Douglas, wondering what had become of Natalie and her quest for petrol, wandered over to the schoolhouse and found her with the Roosevelts. After introductions, it was agreed that Natalie and Douglas would meet with Roosevelt the next day in the Indian Agency, near the school where Agent Crane had set aside spacious quarters for Roosevelt. Douglas had seen the snake dance in 1911, and Roosevelt wanted context before witnessing the ceremony. He also asked Natalie if she would accompany him on his tour of Walpi. Roosevelt had only a few days to absorb Hopi culture and draft his Outlook article about the people of Hopiland. Natalie agreed to help. Roosevelt actually had plenty of expert consultants with him at First Mesa. He was traveling with John Wetherill, surely the most knowledgeable and revered guide in Navajo land. Don Lorenzo Hubble had come to Polaca from Ganado to assist Roosevelt during the snake dance. Hubble was a personal friend of the Roosevelts and had visited the family in February during a trip to Washington for a meeting at the BIA. John, as Roosevelt called Hubble, had also served as a driver and guide for various legs of the Arizona expedition. Later that day, Natalie took Alice and Schindler to see Second and Third Mesas. They rode 12 miles up and down a steep and difficult road to Second Mesa, where they visited friends of Natalie's at the village of Shangopovi. As the afternoon passed into the evening, Natalie, Alice, and Schindler pressed on to Third Mesa, where Natalie hoped to reconnect with Chief Tawakwaptiwa at Old Oribe. They spent the night at New Oribe, a community of federal-issue dwellings and offices at the base of Third Mesa. Natalie was distressed by New Oribe's lack of indigenous architectural characteristics and by the U.S. government's continued insistence on funding and constructing buildings artistically and practically out of sync with Hopiland. The traditional thick-walled, flat-roofed dwellings, stacked several stories high, with shaded overhangs and terraces, had for centuries successfully served the Hopis as they worked, played, socialized, and celebrated in every season of the year. At New Oribe, the traditional Hopi village was replaced by rows of impractical, pitched, tin-roofed dwellings with too many windows that were frying pan hot in the summer and ice-cold in the winter. Natalie had hoped to find improvements in the federal government's management of Indian country. Instead, she found the feds had continued their campaign to weaken the traditional cultures and lifeways of Native America. After a night in one of the government buildings of New Oribe, Natalie woke Alice and Schindler at dawn and led them up the steep foot trail to see Tawakwaptiwa at his home in Old Oribe. To Natalie's great sorrow, she found Tawakwaptiwa was the chief of a diminished pueblo. The once vital village where Natalie and Chief Lololomai had sat and watched sundown from a rooftop was disintegrating back into the dust of Third Mesa. Natalie blamed the community's ruination on the U.S. government's relentless insistence that Hopi children be forcibly taken from their homes and placed in boarding schools, whose goal was to obliterate the cultural heritage of Indian America. In spite of the community's deterioration, the Hopi of Third Mesa continued to perform the flute ceremony. Natalie, Alice, and Schindler joined the mostly native audience to watch one of the most poetic of the traditional Hopi dances. The drama was an invocation of water for the springs below the pueblo, and dancers were dressed as symbols of the sun, the rainbow, and the blossoming earth. The flute dance was of keen interest to Kurt Schindler, who incorporated folk music and indigenous rhythms into his own compositions. While Natalie was at the flute ceremony at Third Mesa, Douglas, who had lived among the Hopis a decade before, assumed the role of cultural tour guide for Roosevelt's entourage. With his son Eric, Douglas retrieved Roosevelt from his rooms in the well-scrubbed schoolhouse and walked the colonel, his two sons, and cousin Nick up the trail to the villages on top of Third Mesa. Roosevelt, who had several days before successfully crossed the infamously difficult and nerve-testing Rainbow Trail to reach Rainbow Bridge, remarked on the precipitousness of the very narrow and steep cliff-hugging path. Douglas took the Roosevelts to meet Nampeo and her family. Nampeo's husband was an old friend of Douglas's, someone, he explained to Roosevelt, to whom he owed much. Winfred Douglas was a man who inspired great loyalty among his friends, and equally great animosity among those who disliked him. What Roosevelt's personal opinion of Canon Douglas was can only be guessed. His Outlook article shared only professional comments about Douglas. Cousin Nick, however, loathed Father Winfred Douglas, whom he had met on this very mesa in 1911. Douglas was a gregarious extrovert, confident and outspoken about his professional and intellectual accomplishments, and ever ready to offer pastoral counsel, comfort, and assistance. Nick Roosevelt had encountered Douglas at the 1911 snake dance at Walpi when he was in high school in Phoenix, and he thought the canon was an insufferable idiot who held forth in stentorian tones as he explained the snake ceremony to a woman friend who was the most remarkable bird the teenager had ever seen. She was attired in less-than-knee-length skirts, was middle-agish, stout, bespectacled, and cock-like, had her hair piled mountain-high over her forehead, wearing upon it a minute green alpine hat, on the top of which sat, in an attitude of possible premeditated flight, an enormous bird. In 1911, Douglas had apparently been in Hopiland with one of his more eccentric friends, likely a European. Whoever she may have been was of no concern to Nick. He did not like the canon in 1911, and his opinion of Douglas would not improve in August 1913. Nick, like Roosevelt's sons Archie and Quentin, guarded the former president's privacy and thought Douglas didn't deserve so much access to Roosevelt. As Nick saw it, Douglas was able to get close and get his claws into Roosevelt only because he was traveling with Roosevelt's friend Natalie Curtis, apparently a real person and a woman of great good sense. Natalie, Alice, and Schindler returned to the peach orchard at the base of First Mesa and spent the afternoon resting in camp. While they napped in the shade, John Hubble took Roosevelt up First Mesa. Roosevelt had been invited to a private meeting with the snake priests in their kiva, the ancient heart of Walpi. The meeting between the snake priests and the man they called the Great White Father from Washington lasted only a quarter of an hour that hot afternoon on August 20th. Roosevelt's descent by ladder into the kiva was the climax of an extraordinary personal journey through Indian country. In the sacred subterranean chamber, the snake priests had been preparing for the snake ceremony for 9 days. Roosevelt knew there would be snakes, lots of snakes, but he was unprepared for the large number of poisonous snakes slithering untethered and uncontained about the kiva floor throughout his audience with the priests. The smoky, dimly lit kiva was decorated with eagle feathers, animal skins, lightning sticks, and paintings of snakes. Roosevelt sat on a blanket in the middle of the chamber, with his back just 8 feet from 30-odd rattlesnakes, most of them in a twined heap in one corner, but a dozen by themselves scattered along the wall. There was also a ceramic pot containing several striped ribbon snakes, too lively to be left at large. One man spoke English and translated the priest's greetings and Roosevelt's questions, but the conference in the kiva that afternoon was mostly silent. Roosevelt did his best to mimic the priest's nonchalance about the venomous participants, which were mostly kept to one side of the kiva by a snake watcher who used a fan made of eagle feathers to redirect those reptiles which wandered too close to Roosevelt. "Every move was made without hurry and with quiet concern," Roosevelt wrote, noting that the religious life of the Hopi contained relics of an almost inconceivably remote and savage past, but also a mystic symbolism which has in it elements that are ennobling. Archie, Quentin, and Nick greeted Roosevelt when he climbed out through the top of the kiva into the blindingly bright Pueblo Plaza, burning with enthusiasm. The remainder of that afternoon, and long into the evening, the schoolhouse below First Mesa functioned as Roosevelt's impromptu office. Nick served as clerk and timekeeper for the droves of dignitaries, politicians, and celebrities who appeared to pay their respects to the ex-president. Governor George W. P. Hunt of Arizona came to Polaca from Phoenix with a press entourage of photographers, motion picture people, and a writer from Collier's magazine. Even though he was the wounded Republican-turned-progressive spoiler, a photo op with Roosevelt was highly valued by politicians. Natalie's scheduled appointment with Roosevelt commenced in the evening, after everyone, Natalie, Alice, Douglas, Schindler, and Whitaker, plus the Roosevelt clan, trekked up First Mesa at dusk to observe the Antelope Dance, a ceremonial precursor to the Snake Dance. Douglas joined Natalie and Roosevelt at the schoolhouse for a discussion that lasted long into the night. Roosevelt wanted Natalie's and Douglas's input on the Outlook article he was drafting about the Hopis, but Natalie had her own agenda, and as Roosevelt well knew from a dozen meetings at Sagamore Hill and in the White House, she was not easily deterred. Natalie bluntly asked Roosevelt what right the U.S. government had to stretch forth an autocratic hand arbitrarily to change the village life of this ancient and peaceful folk. She then proceeded to lecture him on the function and design of the historic Hopi villages that for centuries had existed in harmony with their natural surroundings. Natalie complained about buildings like the schoolhouse they sat in, designed with no eye to either beauty or usefulness that the BIA forced upon the Hopis. And she asked Roosevelt just when would the Fed study the Indian culture they sought to change? Until some great foundation like the Carnegie or Rockefeller shall endow funds for a study of this kind, Natalie concluded, and until the whole matter of white man control of Indians can be lifted out of politics, our efforts at Indian education are bound to be like the rain-shedding roofs in the desert, misfits in spirit as in fact. Roosevelt had heard these grievances from Natalie before, but that August night he was hearing them while sitting in a BIA schoolroom at the base of First Mesa, deep in Indian country. In the Indians' book, Natalie wrote that one would only understand Hopi music when it was heard in the environment from which it was born, in the wide land, amid the shifting color of the tinted sands and the purple-blue of the sharp-shadowed rocks, the very landscape Roosevelt had been immersed within for the last 6 weeks. That evening, Roosevelt had stood on the lip of the mesa and watched dusk descend to the haunting rhythm of the Antelope Dance, and that afternoon he had shared with dozens of snakes the packed mud floor of a kiva that echoed with the chants of the snake priests. Roosevelt had stepped into the heart of Native America, and he had been changed by it. Roosevelt assured Natalie he would use the power of his pen to educate the American public about Indian culture. "For somehow, people do listen to me." Roosevelt had drafted Across the Navajo Desert about his trip from the Grand Canyon to Kayenta and Rainbow Bridge. He read the article aloud to Natalie and Douglas and asked for corrections or suggestions. Natalie offered a few changes to strengthen the text. "I was amazed at the electric snap with which the colonel would grasp a suggestion," Natalie later wrote, "and without a moment's hesitation put it into a written form far clearer and more succinct than the suggester could have supplied." The article, penned in longhand, would be mailed to the Outlook offices in New York from Hubbell's at Ganado the next evening. Natalie was impressed by Roosevelt's productivity while traveling on horseback through the outback, and asked him when and how he had found the time and circumstances in which to write. Roosevelt smiled and commented that he liked the strenuous life. Before dawn on August 21st, with the steady light of two morning stars, Mercury and Venus, glimmering over the desert, and with the glow of the night fires of Walpi flickering on the rim of the mesa above them, Natalie, Alice, Douglas, Eric, Schindler, and Whitaker left the warmth of their bedrolls and made a pot of coffee over the campfire. Before leaving the schoolhouse the night before, Natalie promised Roosevelt she would come for him before sunrise, and together they would walk up the steep, dark trail to Walpi. Archie, Quentin, and Nick were not housed with Roosevelt, but camped nearby with John Wetherill. In the half-dark, Natalie dressed, filled a thermos with coffee, and went to find Roosevelt. But Roosevelt's room was empty, and as she walked back to the camp in the peach orchard, Natalie reminded herself that one must indeed get up very early to keep up with the colonel. Natalie and her campmate skipped breakfast and scrambled up to the summit of First Mesa. They found Roosevelt high on a stone ledge, silhouetted against the yellow line of the dawn, with his two sons and cousin, Roosevelt, led by John Wetherill, had ridden on horseback up the First Mesa Trail. Roosevelt brushed off Natalie's apology for being so tardy, but accepted her thermos of hot coffee. As the sun rose above the horizon, the mostly Hopi crowd waiting on the edge of First Mesa cheered the return of ceremonial runners as they completed a 6-mile race. With sunrise came the first trickle of what would become the great flood of visitors to First Mesa. The snake dance would begin around 5 p.m., and throughout the day hundreds of white tourists and dignitaries ascended the vertigo-inducing trail to Walpi. Nick Roosevelt estimated some 800 people made the climb to the old village, and that the audience was four times as large as that which attended the snake dance in 1911. Alice and Schindler were introduced to Roosevelt that morning. Alice liked Roosevelt immensely, and she thanked him for his good work for the Indians and for America. Alice had carried her copy of the Indians' book in her saddlebag for 11 days, and she asked Roosevelt to inscribe it. Inside the front page, he penned, "In a Hopi Indian Pueblo, to Alice Klauber, with all good wishes, from Theodore Roosevelt, Walpi, August 21st, 1913. Nick Roosevelt ignored Douglas when they stood face to face on Walpi, but he was impressed by and eager to be introduced to Kurt Schindler, the terrific genius so much spoken of at the Opera House in New York's musical circles. Schindler knew Nick's sister, Lorraine Roosevelt Warner of Boston, whom Nick thought Natalie resembled in size and demeanor. Like everyone else standing around Roosevelt, Schindler had spent weeks traveling by horseback across the Arizona desert, and the usually pressed, shaven, and showered Schindler scarcely resembled the conductor toasted by New York's effete music circles. Schindler, introduced to the Roosevelts as being no tenderfoot, was as brown as the natives, and although he wore the costume of a musician, the hair hung below his ears and was tied down with a bandana. The morning Nick met him, Schindler had apparently forgotten to put on a shirt. After lunch, Natalie, Alice, Douglas, et al. Left the shade of the orchard and walked again up to Walpi. By mid-afternoon, all the dirt roads leading to First Mesa were crowded with people coming for the snake dance. They came on foot, in wagons, and on horseback, and from the Mesa top, we watched the automobiles crawling over the sand like an eruption of ugly and alien beetles. Such a heterogeneous crowd as flocked from all directions to watch the colonel watch the Indians. Natalie had been assigned a seat beside Roosevelt, his sons, and Governor Hunt, front and center to the ceremony that would be performed on the plaza. Douglas, Alice, Schindler, and their campmates, like John Wetherill and Don Lorenzo Hubbell, had to find a place in the great mob. The crowd around the plaza became so large that people climbed up onto the rooftops and lined the village's rock walls. The Pueblo's small plaza ended abruptly in a sheer drop to the desert floor, hundreds of feet below. But dozens of spectators, anxious for a view of the dance and the former president watching the dance, took positions along the mesa's dangerous precipice. The whole scene on Walpi reminded Nick of the Republican convention. Reporters, photographers, and moving picture men joined the mob of the idle curious and the near great. Before the Roosevelts reached their assigned seats at the base of a wall to one side of the plaza, the colonel was stopped several dozen times by men and women asking for an autograph or reaching out to shake his famous hand. Roosevelt obliged everyone. Natalie walked into Walpi alongside Roosevelt. In the last 2 weeks of camping, she had somehow managed to keep one outfit free of desert grime, dust, mud, horsehair, and axle grease, and she floated into the snake dance wearing a pristine white cotton shirt and skirt, her face shaded by an enormous white hat. The clicking sound of rapid-fire Kodak cameras followed Roosevelt's entourage as it moved through the narrow walkways of the Hopi village. By Nicholas's estimate, they were photographed exactly 16 million times. Before the dance commenced, the crowd, now stacked three stories high on ledges and rooftops surrounding the plaza, was given a preliminary speech about the sacredness of the ceremony and instructed that there was to be silence throughout its duration. The speaker was an Indian service official. Douglas and Natalie actually instigated the pre-performance cultural lecture, although they had suggested Roosevelt stand and address the crowd before the ceremony. This idea was quickly nixed as inappropriate. The ceremony commenced when the snakes, the same serpents seen by Roosevelt on the floor of the kiva the day before, were brought into the plaza in bags by the snake priests and placed in the kisi, a shallow pit covered with a board that represented the underworld. The snake's arrival in the crowded plaza was followed by the solemn line of chanting antelope and snake priests. Two antelope priests accompanied each individual snake priest as he was given one of the snakes and proceeded trance-like around the plaza. The rattlesnakes were first carried in the priest's hands. When the snakes were transferred to the priest's mouths, the assisting antelope priests helped the dancer support the weight of the snake and also stroked and calmed the rattlesnakes with feathers. Roosevelt saw several dancers bitten by snakes, but the priests did not seem to suffer ill consequences from the poisonous strikes. As the mass of onlookers pressed in within an arm's length of the dancers and their venomous partners, the procession of snake and antelope priests chanted and stomped four times around the plaza. At the end of the spirited, dramatic ceremony, the snakes were tossed down into a circle. With their bare hands, each of the antelope priests retrieved half a dozen snakes each and dashed out of the plaza with them and down the steep sides of First Mesa to the desert floor, where they released the sacred reptiles into the four directions. As the mob of spectators climbed down from their perches on Walpi's dwellings and walls, Natalie said her farewells to Roosevelt. She hoped to see him back east after his trip to South America later in the fall. Natalie wove her way out of the throng, pressing in to see Roosevelt, and found Alice and Douglas. After regrouping with their campmates, they walked across the mesa to Hano to watch the sunset from Nampeo's home. The legions of white people headed back to their autos and civilization, and Hopi First Mesa returned to normal. Roosevelt and his family packed up their expedition gear, said farewell to their horses, Navajo guides, and their very good friend John Wetherill, and piled into John Hubble's two Ford machines to drive into the night to Ganado. Natalie and Douglas's expedition remained in Hopiland another week. Natalie set up a workshop at their campsite near Palaka, and many Hopi friends came to share stories and songs with her in the shade of the peach trees. One of the snake priests who had sat with Roosevelt in the kiva, named Harry, was an old friend of Natalie's, and he spent an afternoon telling stories and singing with Tawimana and her white friends. Natalie sang almost as many songs for the Hopis as they sang for her. Schindler scribbled notes throughout Natalie's sessions with native singers. When he returned to New York, he planned to incorporate the native melodies and folk rhythms of Hopiland into his own compositions. On the morning of August 24th, Canon Douglas held an outdoor mass in the orchard near their campsite. After an Episcopalian service under the wide Arizona sky, Natalie, Alice, and the men packed up camp and walked the trail to Hano one more time to say goodbye to Nampeo. Over the next few days, they camped in the open country near Second and Third Mesas. Natalie wanted to connect with several Hopi singers, including Chief Tawakwaktiwa, who came to see her when she returned with her group and set up camp below Old Oribe. Alice carried the Indian's book in her saddlebag, and on the same page signed by Natalie and Roosevelt, the chief wrote, Kwaktiwi, Hopi Chief, Oribe, August 24, 1913. During one of these private sessions with the Hopi chiefs and priests, Alice received her Hopi name, Koya Ho Inim. Ted Whitaker was also given a Hopi name, but no one's diary recorded what that name was. After several days in the village of Haute Villa, the community founded by the Hostiles, who departed Oribe in 1906, Natalie and friends rode east to the Toriva Spring and camped near Second Mesa. At the ancient Hopi village of Shangopovi, they were invited to observe the flute ceremony. The ceremony beside the spring at Shangopovi was rarely, if ever, viewed by outsiders. Douglas later wrote about the procession and dance, and he became credited as perhaps the first white man to see this particular Hopi ceremony. News and letters from the outside world awaited Natalie, Alice, and the others on their return to the BIA offices in Palaka. After a final stop for supplies at Hubble's trading post, they rode southwest out of Tusayan into the painted desert of the Navajos. It was very hot. The monsoons had passed, and the dry landscape shimmered with ghostly mirages as they rode southeast for Indian Wells. After a final night under the open sky of the high desert, they packed up the horses one more time, and their great journey across Indian country came to an end the next afternoon when they rode into Holbrook. After a fitful night in hotel rooms that felt confining and airless, they carried their gear and bags to the Santa Fe Railway Depot and boarded the eastbound train. 200 miles east across the desert, the train stopped at Laguna Pueblo, New Mexico. Everyone disembarked except for Schindler, who was to remain on the train bound for Chicago and New York. After 22 days of fellowship on the desert, Natalie, Alice, Douglas, Eric, Schindler, and Whitaker